Okay, today we're going to be looking at the Book of Ruth in our daily truth-based highlights. It's a tiny book. It's got four chapters, so we have a prayer of getting through it today. Its basic theme is that the decisions that we make determine our destiny, and that is true in almost every area of our life, particularly in the spiritual. You basically are a product of the decisions that you have made throughout the course of your life, which is both good news and bad news. The bad news is you're responsible for where you are. The good news is that if you don't like where you are, you can always change it. So there's really cool themes in this book. We're only going to highlight a few of them. For those of you who are, you know, kind of like the big picture survey part, there's after the law, five books of Moses, there's Joshua, Judges, and Ruth, three little books, and then you get into Samuel and, you know, Kings and Chronicles and all those historical books. And then when you get to the Old Testament, there are also three historical books, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. So the history progresses and the narrative progresses in Joshua and Judges, and then Ruth is a little vignette of what life was like during the period of Judges. And similarly, in Ezra and Esther, a lot of the history of the nation of Israel progresses, and then we have this little vignette of what life was like during the time of Nehemiah, both of them, by focusing on the life of Esther. So it's kind of interesting that there are these two little books. The second one isn't that little, but they are named after women, and the women are the major characters in the book. In one of them, God is very active. His name is mentioned a bunch of times. That's the book of Ruth. In the other, the name of God is not mentioned at all. If you go into Daily Truth Base, you can see where we found the hidden names of God. In the book of Ruth, they are actually in the promised land or back in the promised land. In the book of Esther, they are out of it. So there's some comparisons and contrast, and I think the Holy Spirit arranged these books in this order to kind of give a little insight into what was going on and also to make a point and a message. This book was probably written by the last judge, the first prophet. His name was Samuel, who wrote the books of Samuel, because he's reflecting back on the days of Judges. And he actually writes this for a purpose that is almost outside the story of Ruth, but to give the genealogy leading up to David, which doesn't exist except for what's in the book of Ruth. So most of you know this. We sung a song written about it. It's got some good things. So the basic theme of the book, which is also my first outline point, is the providence. That means God working all things together for good, God composing a grand piece out of various music of your life. The providence of God and the faithful, loyal obedience of individuals blend to bring about blessing out of tragedy. And the little word that I've got here that most of you are familiar with, chesed, as a CH in Hebrew, is this concept of covenant loyalty. And loyalty is, I think, the first component of our relationship with God in terms of loving Him. It's also the first component of our relationship with each other. And Ruth demonstrates an incredible loyalty. And I've been going through this, I've been asking myself, why does she do that? And I don't really, maybe we can talk about it later in the discussion time, but we're not explicitly told, but she demonstrates this loyalty. Could have been a cultural thing, but it's basically the basis of her blessing, and her blessing weren't just for her lifetime. She basically becomes, from outside of Israel, a part of Israel, and not only that, a forebearer of David, and it's his line that's the forerunners of the Messiah. So this incredible position of honor is given to this, you know, basically poor Moabite widow who had like zero prospects. So we're going to see how that all came about as we go through the book. But the thing to keep in mind is, yeah, God's in control, but your actions are necessary to bring about His plan. And Ruth was just great on doing the submitting and serving part that we as New Testament believers are called to do. So I believe as Samuel wrote, he says, when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So we're not told where this is in Judges. When you work out the genealogy, it looks like it would probably be around the time of Samson, because they had actually pushed the Moabites out. people go back to Deborah, people go back to Ehud, who was a Moabite, who got the guy, king of the Moabites, got the sword stuck in him. None of the commentators make a clear case for when this is, because nobody knows. But there was a man from Bethlehem. He took his wife, a gal named Naomi, and they went to dwell in the country of Moab, who were former oppressors of them, and who by and large were not very favorably inclined to them, but we're going to go back and find out that they were actually they were descendants of Abraham through Lot. So Abraham's bloodline via Lot, your nephew, was present there. The Moabites actually happened to be people who Israel was not told to exterminate, and they were not prohibited from marrying among them. So this guy goes there with Naomi, their two sons. The two sons pick up Moabite woman, Opal or Opa, whatever her name is, and Naomi, and Ruth. And then tragedy strikes. The man dies. So now Naomi is a widow. And then her two sons die. So now we got these three widows living together. And, this is a time when, you really needed a guy in your life and for protection, for, lots of reasons. So it wasn't looking good. But then Naomi hears that Yahweh, and this is out of the World English Bible, which is what I use for Daily Truth Base, so I could edit it without copyright infringement, had visited his people in giving them bread. So verse 6, she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, because she heard that now God was blessing his people. They had food. Let's go back. So they went on their way to return to the land of Judah, which is across the river. Moab is probably present-day Jordan, east side of the Jordan River, for those of you who like geography. And they went on their way. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return, each of you, to your mother's house." And then in chapter 15, she says, "Even go back to the old gods." So the people are kind of, she wants what their best interest is. People think she's good. A number of people actually don't like her. They think she's one of the bad girls of the Old Testament. But she actually had a good heart. The problem was she didn't have a good view of God, and she kind of thought most of the stuff depended on her, and she does some things that probably are not great. Here, she's actually encouraging her daughters-in-law to go back to their old gods, which, wait a minute. And then she says, "May Yahweh bless you. May Yahweh show covenantal loyalty to you as you have dealt with the dead and with me." So she's been impressed by the fact that God has, through her daughters-in-law, ministered to Naomi. And then she basically doesn't demonstrate loyalty to God, which is I don't understand how that is. And would you tell someone, go back to your old gods, don't follow Jesus? So, for that reason, a lot of people, and other reasons that we're going to see in a few minutes, a lot of people don't think that highly of her. But I don't think she's mean-hearted. I think she is just, she doesn't have a good relationship with God, and it shows up. Some people think that, her sons were killed because they married Moabite women. As I mentioned earlier, that wasn't prohibited. It's just what happened. I guess the food in Moab isn't that good. Anyway, so... and then she says, "May Yahweh grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." She kissed them. They lifted up their voice and wept. She said to them, they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." And Naomi says, "No, the hand of Yahweh is against me." She really can't see that God could allow bad things into her life for her benefit. Because God's got a plan. He wants to get a forerunner of the Messiah back into the land for him to be born there. But, obviously she doesn't know that. It's kind of like the book of Job. We don't know what's going on. A theme that a lot of people harp on in the book, which I think is a decent one, is this concept of rest. And it's kind of, God bringing people into the promised land to find rest and you know, kind of general sense of well-being. Second time it shows up in the scriptures is Numbers 10. And I think this is where Moses is kind of talking to someone about going back to maybe his father-in-law, going back to their house or staying with them or whatever. But the thing that I want you to notice there is that the ark went before them to lead them to their rest when they really didn't know where they were going. All they knew is that they were supposed to follow the ark. And this is basically a key to the Christian life. Follow the sailboat. No, follow the ark. This was called the Ark of the Covenant. What was in the Ark of the Covenant? The covenant. So we're going to do a little metaphorical thing here where we want to follow what the covenant says as our means for rest. So follow the ark. It guides you to the right spot. Just like another kind of ark protected Noah, the law that's in the ark will protect you. And it did so with Ruth. So she kissed them, said goodbye, return, Yahweh's against me. And then Ruth, now this is the New King James Version in the non-italicized type, said, "Don't ask me to leave you or turn back from following after you." And then this great lines, possibly even chiastic structure, "Where you go, I'll go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people and your God, my God." She's demonstrating allegiance to both God and the people of God. "Where you die, I will die." And basically, "Where you be buried, there I will be buried as well. And may the Lord do terrible things to me." Actually, Holman Christian Study Bible says, like, "Punish me. If anything but death parts you and me." So she's committed to following the God of Naomi, the people of Naomi, till she dies. Just like there's a loyalty there that is really amazing. And when Naomi saw that Ruth was determined or steadfastly minded, as one of the translations say, to go with her, you know, she stopped trying to persuade her to leave. So this decision of Naomi sets all the blessings in place. She goes from being, you know, a widow in Midianite who was married to previously to a non-Midianite, has no inheritance, nothing to look forward to basically being highly blessed among women and a forerunner of the Messiah. Just because of this decision and some actions that go along with it. I'm sorry. Midian. Yes, it's Moab's. And then they get home, they're having a farewell party. Hey, Naomi's back. And she says, "Don't call me Naomi," which means, like, you know, pretty one or whatever. "Call me Mara," which means bitter. "For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, and Yahweh has brought me home again empty." Bad Yahweh. "Why do you call me Naomi? Since Yahweh has testified against me, and the Almighty has afflicted me." Well, she's not very happy. I'm sure that kind of put a little damper on the welcome back party. We're going to see it's all not bleak. But, you know, people who are having troubles tend to lose perspective. She probably didn't pay a whole lot of attention to the book of Job. Job had a lot of afflictions, and if she read that book, which would have been in the canon by then, she would have recognized that God afflicts the righteous for a reason. If she had read Psalms, actually Psalm 11 hadn't been written yet, one of the things that God does is he tries the righteous. So she basically has lost perspective, and even though she's home and everybody's happy to see her, she's there still wrapped up in, "What about me?" You know, it's like, oh. And then she is basically blaming God for her problems. In one sense, God has allowed the problems. If she had been righteous, then she would have the confidence to say, you know, God is trying me, testing me, and I know it's going to work out for good. But she can't say that because she isn't really had that confidence before God, because her actions are probably not above reproach. In fact, we're going to see a little later, she's actually very deceptive in how she deceitful in her scheming to try to bring about God's purposes, which also is not a good idea. So we have a little application here. In difficult times, are you actively loyal to God or bitter or resentful that your boss makes you stay late, or that your coworker doesn't do what they're supposed to do, or what you asked for doesn't come about, or what you've been wanting, God says no, because it's not good for you? You know, it's like you basically need to maintain active loyalty to God regardless, even to the point of death. The other thing is, don't allow circumstances to determine your identity. If you are, here she's looking at her circumstances and then says, call me bitter. Wow, she's just totally controlled by her circumstances, which is like not really smart. Someone being purified by God, that would be a good one. Bring it on, because it's for my benefit. But she doesn't have that perspective because she really doesn't know God. And the thing which also struck me as strange when I was first reading this is like, why would Ruth follow this bitter, resentful woman? Like, what kind of testimony is that? So I can't figure out how Ruth managed to see through all that, except that God had some purposes for Ruth and maybe gave her grace to continue to trust him. But in the midst of tough times, we want to be a good testimony so that others are drawn to Christ. In fact, it was the blood of martyrs that watered the seed of the truth that caused Christianity to take over the Roman Empire. People being afflicted, being tortured, being killed. And the Romans said, wow, those Christians die well. There must be something to this. And I'm sure there are some Christians that are there saying, oh, woe is me, why me? Take someone else. But that's the way life is. Okay, then we get to chapter 2. So the thing that strikes me about this chapter is Ruth's humble submission. She, you're going to see her actually, when she gets blessed, she bows to the ground and puts her head on the ground. I mean, can you ever imagine yourself doing that? Of course not. There are germs down there. It's like, it might have been a cultural thing, but it's like, she actually follows what she gets told to do. She also, I was struck by, and you read the thing, it's like four little chapters, and I'm not going to be able to go into all of it, how self-initiating she was. She, basically had the right, she would take action, but it was the right kind of action. She had wholehearted service to Naomi and others, and the result was blessing. So the decision determined her destiny. The decision to be humble, the submission to submit, the decision to do what she could do and do it wholeheartedly resulted in blessing. So they're there, they're back, farewell party's over. And Ruth said to the Naomi, let me now go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. So a lot of you know the Old Testament mandated that you not reap every single corner of your field, but it was a form of social welfare. You left some grain behind. You didn't have to take every penny off the table so that the poor could go and gather it. And we're going to see that Boaz, whose field she found, not only followed the law, he went way beyond what the law required in terms of his concern and generosity towards others, a very righteous kind of guy. A hallmark of righteousness is you don't just do the minimum what the law says, but you are generous. So Naomi is here basically saying, okay, I can go gather grain. It's a thing. So I'm not sure where I'm going to go, but I'm going to trust that I'll find favor in someone's sight. And then she asks permission to do it. And then she just so happens to, quinkadink, God's at work, go to the field of Boaz. Now, it's not a huge, huge, huge stretch for her to be there because he was a kinsman. It was, similar folks. And God had a plan to best bless Boaz, and it was through this young gal, Ruth. So, when he sees what she's doing, and he basically tells the guys, don't mess with her, because days of judges, you did tend to mess with people that you get away with messing with. And he is very generous to her. She fell on her face, bowed herself to the ground, okay, face and ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me? Since, like, I'm a foreigner. I'm like one of your previous enemies. Why would you be so kind to me?" So she isn't just like some clueless babe. She's basically like, this is unusual. Boab answered her, "It has been fully shown me," and really he was made aware of, "all that you have done to your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you have left your father and your mother and the land of your birth and have come to a people that you didn't know before. May the Lord repay." There it is. The Lord pays back. Had she not done this stuff, she wouldn't be in this position. "Your work, and may a full reward be given to you from Yahweh, the God of Israel, the one under whose wings you have come to take refuge." So, she had shown loyalty to her mother-in-law, took care of her, even though the mother-in-law actually couldn't do much to help her. And she has committed herself to follow Yahweh, the God of the Israelites, and his God, their God would be her God. She is committing herself to his care and protection. And she had done this to an extent that others knew about it. And then she said, "Let me find favor," word for favor there is grace, "in your sight, my Lord, because you have comforted me and because you have spoken kindly to your handmaiden, even though I am not as one of your servants." Some of your versions actually say slaves. So here Boaz is demonstrating this character where he's concerned about the needs of others, and basically treating her as one of his household, even though she isn't. And she's very aware of how much she's been blessed. People tend to be very clueless about how much blessing has been given to them, both from God and others. But here she is demonstrating gratitude, which is a very good characteristic to cultivate. So she goes back home. She's got a lot of barley. I think someone said it was like 26 quarts. It's kind of a lot. And the reason she got so much is Boaz told the guys, drop some grain behind you. So here they gathered it and dropped it. Yeah. Maintaining her dignity. It's a workfare program. It's really good. Some of you might be thinking, so I'm not a farmer. I don't have fields. What do I do? You can still practice generosity and awareness of others' needs and figure out how to do that. And I know there are lots of examples in the body where that happens. So the mother-in-law, this is Naomi, says to Ruth, "Where have you gleaned today? Where have you worked? Blessed be he who noticed you. And blessed be he of Yahweh, because Yahweh has not left off his kindness to the living and the dead. This guy Boaz is one of our near kinsman redeemer." All right, a couple things I want you to notice in here. Of this particular section, Naomi goes from bitter that God has afflicted her to realize God is now blessing me, and the agent of this is twofold: Boaz, the kinsman, and Ruth, the gleaner. So had Ruth not, been motivated to go out and work and not demonstrated the proper humility and not demonstrated the proper gratitude, all of which were decisions, she probably would not have gotten blessed, and certainly Naomi would not have been able to had God exalted in her sight. This hesed is also shows up here, that Yahweh does fulfill his covenant obligations. And a lot of your versions will say kinsman. The word 73 times, I mean, it's 13 times is translated kinsman, 73 times is translated redeemer. And God appointed the fact that if someone lost their land, it couldn't be sold to an outsider. Someone in the tribe had to buy it, because in those days it was really important to have land that was always going to be yours, So you could farm because you couldn't go down to your local grocery store to pick up food, and you couldn't just go to work somewhere. You had to grow it, and you needed land to do that. So the kinsman had to be someone in your tribe who would redeem or buy back your land had you mortgaged it or gone into debt with it or whatever, so that it would always stay in the tribe and it could be passed down through the line. The other obligation was if a guy's brother died and didn't have any kids, you would be, it's called the Levirate law, you would be obligated to marry your brother's widow and give her kids. And we're going to see a story a little later with Tamar that is mentioned at the end of this book, which actually sheds a little more light on what's going on in the book, where that case, Genesis 38, occurred. So, from Ruth's actions, we can surmise a few principles. We must decide how we're going to live. We must decide what our associations are going to be, what our allegiances are going to be, all in reference to God. So we need to look at life from God's perspective, what He has said for all areas of our life. And I just highlighted some of the ones. Your people will be my people. She's loyal to Naomi, and Boaz is loyal to his obligations. And they're doing this to carry out God's purposes for their land. For those of you who want a little simple thing, submit and serve even in scary times. Submission can be scary, but if you have a big God, it's not. Serving can be difficult, but if you have a strong God, it's not. And if you just keep focused on doing those things that God has said, then you will have peace and rest. All right, then we get to the potentially salacious part of the book. Simple, virtuous trust in following the scriptures is superior to sketchy scheming. All right, so I mentioned earlier that Naomi was a schemer. She didn't really trust God as she should have. He was not in the picture. She's always trying to work out some plan. And she actually ropes Ruth into the plan. And fortunately, their character saves them. So I need to tell you a couple things about the Moabites. I'll mention one now. Lot was a nephew of Abraham in Sodom and Gomorrah. When God put the judgment on there, they fled. And I think his wife looked back and turned to a pillar of salt. Was that that one? You know, I'm not really good at these Bible stories because I never went to Sunday school. But I read the Bible once, and it does have something like that in it. And this is the story where the progenitor of the Moabites is Lot's eldest daughter, who comes up with this grand plan with her kid sister. Let's get dad drunk and basically get impregnated so we'll have kids. So Genesis 19:37. And Lot is so drunk, he doesn't know what's going on, and it happens again. The Ammonites came from the younger daughter. The older daughter had the Moabites. So knowing that background leads me to believe that something in the Moabite DNA is a thing for older men. maybe not. I don't know. But you're going to see this happens again a little later. So here's Naomi saying, Ruth, I will seek rest for you, that it may be well with you. So Naomi keeps looking at things from a secular perspective. She wants to do what's right, but it doesn't quite get the trust God piece. So she hatches this plan to seduce Boaz. Boaz, our kinsman, winnows barley tonight in the threshing floor. So at the end of the harvest, they would take all the barley sheaves and they would, you know, basically thresh it out, they drive the sled over it, they beat it up, you know, they throw away the chaff and all that stuff. And at the end, you have all this great barley that was going to feed you for the rest of the season, right, basically through to the next harvest. That this gathering in of all this food is a harvest festival that almost all cultures have, where you celebrate because, hey, we're going to be able to eat for a while. And there's a party and reveille and drinking and all other good stuff. So, She says, therefore, wash yourself, perfume yourself. Word for anoint is with perfume. Someone said that the perfume she wore was a midnight in Moab, but J. Vernon McGee came up with that. He was an old-time radio preacher. So anyway, get dressed. Some of your other versions say get dressed up in your good clothes and go down to the threshing floor. But don't make yourself known to the man until he's finished eating and drinking and he's drunk as a skunk. It shall be that when he lies down, note the place where he shall lie. And basically when he's asleep, go in and uncover his feet and lay down, and he will tell you what you should do. And Ruth said, all that you say, I will do, and did according to all told her. Okay, so the scene is set. What Naomi is thinking is, okay, the guy's going to be drunk. We send this cute young thing all dressed up in the middle of the night. He's happy. He won't know what's going on. And he'll basically want to take Naomi as his wife, concubine, whatever. But that doesn't work out that way. Here's why. Because the two of them are pretty virtuous. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, I think the Hebrew term for this is three sheets to the wind. He went down, went to what? It's a nautical term. He asked Joseph about it. Oh, come on. If you actually trace that term through the scriptures, it really means pretty drunk. He went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. She came softly, uncovered her feet, and laid herself down. And it happened around midnight that he kind of got a little more sober, startled, turned himself, and behold, whoa, what's this babe doing at my feet? So uncovering a person's feet is used as a metaphor for sexual relations, which did not happen because when they actually do have relations in the next chapter, it's different terminology. But it was considered that you were basically asking for the person's protection. You were asking for a relationship with them. And Boaz actually refuses. He said to her, who are you? And she says, I am Ruth, your handmaiden, servant or slave. Therefore, spread your skirt or wing, same word, over your handmaiden, for you are our near kinsman. So, remember she sought shelter under Yahweh's wing, and now is a symbol of seeking shelter under his protection. Although the circumstances under which it is happening are pretty sketchy. The normal thing would have been Naomi would have gone to the matchmaker or to Boaz and, you know, said, hey, you know, kinsman, you know, blah, blah, blah. But Naomi doesn't want to trust that that would work out. So she comes up with her scheme that we're going to make Boaz into our trap, and then we've got him, and we got his protection. But Boaz didn't fall for it because he's a virtuous guy. And he said, blessed are you by Yahweh, my daughter, as opposed to hot babe. You have shown more kindness, hesed, in the latter and at the beginning, inasmuch as you didn't follow young men, whether rich or poor. So he's really touched that she went for the older guy, rather than some young stud. And he is, you know, basically saying that she's showing some great loyalty. I don't quite understand how that loyalty figures out, but this is even better than the beginning in his mindset. So, my daughter, don't be afraid. I'll tell you all that you say. I will do all to you, all that you say. For all the city of my people does know that you are a worthy woman. Virtuous woman. The word actually means basic strong. So, big strong woman. Carry lots of barley. No, it's this shows up in Proverbs 31 twice as the woman who is to be praised. And if you think about what is it that gives a woman her strength, it's not just CrossFit or going to the gym three times a week. If you look at Proverbs 31, And you look at Ruth and you say, how can I put together a understanding of this word for strength that relates specifically to women based on the evidence in these passages? And I just gave you a really good Bible study technique. You'd find out their strength is their character, and their character is reflected in what they do. And if you want to look at what a person does, you will tell what the person is like. It's not just what they say, it's what they do. Look at Ruth, and as you go back and read the first couple chapters before we get to this point, she is demonstrating a great, loyal, submissive, trusting character. Look at the Proverbs 31 woman. Praiseworthy, trustworthy, and both of them were pretty hard workers. And everyone knew of their character. So the same word was used of Boaz. Probably, you know, he was a good character, she was a good character. So Naomi's plan has just exploded. But Boaz goes on, it's true that I am a near kinsman, and it's true that you're a really hot babe. However, which, you know, based on what he just said, he really likes her. There is a kinsman nearer than I am, and it's basically his responsibility first. So here, righteous Boab, who does more than the law requires, is following the law here, saying, hey, I really love this relationship, but there's another person that has a prior claim, so I'm going to have to, you know, go to him first. And if he doesn't want to redeem the land in you, then I will. She lay at his feet until the morning. She rose up before one could discern another. That means before the sun came out. And Boaz says, let it not be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. He doesn't want to damage her reputation. I think he's a lot more concerned about that than he is about his own. And there might have been some of his servants that, could have seen or heard what was going on. But, a woman coming to the threshing floor was normally for less than savory purposes. So he is protective of her, not just her welfare and well-being, but her character as well. Roman numeral 4. He's not necessarily single. Multiple wives and in fact, I ran into this Asian couple just when I was getting my blood tested, and I was developing a relationship with them, and I asked them about grocery store, and then they were kind of surprised that I knew so much about. They were from Taiwan, and I mentioned, oh, the real China, and they said, well, how do you know about that? And we had this conversation, and it came out that some of my friends were Asian, and it says, we have a son who's 30. And I said, oh, I know some great Christian gals that are 40. Anyway, he works for a bank. Yeah, he works for Citibank. He's not married. He's looking. I think he's just looking for one. At least they're looking for one for him. Anyway, so Roman numeral 4. You can pray because they have a daily truth base card. Okay, we have the daily truth base. We're talking about that, and they did invite me to go hiking with a bunch of senior citizens. But anyway. I only walk with young people. So anyway, patiently trusting God to bring about what is best when it's best does not preclude serving and living by faith in his promises. Okay, it's wordy. Unpack it, break it down, figure out what it says. We got to patiently trust God to bring about what's best, which doesn't mean we don't do anything. We need to figure out what the next steps are. Think about following the ark. You did not have a map on the side of the ark that said, this way to the promised land, and here we are. The arrow updated as you move closer and closer. All you knew is the next steps you needed to take. Ruth did not know about, you know, that this was going to be the guy who was the Redeemer, but she did know she needed to get green. She just took the next steps. And one of the Bible programs that I listen, you know, pops up every morning when I say good morning to my Alexa, was Proverbs 19 something or other. It says, you know, thy word is a light, the path, a lamp to my feet. And one of the things about that is the lamps of those days only showed you the next step to take. They didn't show you, you know, what the grand plan was. They were not maps. They were lamps that just showed you what the next step is. So we basically need to live by faith in his promises, taking the next steps. So here they have to trust that if Boaz is going to get Ruth, then they have to basically trust that the Redeemer, the nearer kinsman Redeemer, is going to turn down the opportunity to redeem the land. And possibly part of this was also in Boaz's mind as to why he didn't want anyone to know about Ruth coming there, because, you know, it might mess up the deal. So he goes to the town hall or the village gate where the elders are and where business was transacted and other people are hanging around. And he explains the situation that, you know, you need to buy back Naomi's land. You're the next guy. The guy says, oh, great, I'll take it. Great land. I've always wanted that section. Yeah. And then he said, oh, on the day that you buy the field from Naomi, you must buy it also from Ruth, the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead on his inheritance. So this is a Levirate marriage that I talked about earlier. So you basically need to perpetuate the guy's line. This is a big thing back then. I don't think it's that big a deal here. I want to have my name live on. But that's, for some people, that's a big deal. And then the guy says, oh, I can't redeem it for myself because I might mar my own inheritance. You take my right of redemption. So he turns it down. And everybody who's rooting for Boaz and Ruth, he heaves a big sigh of relief. Phew. Because then he would have had to share it with the descendants of Ruth. And maybe he was small, maybe he'd buy the land, but he didn't want to have any other obligations beyond that. It could have been a form of unrighteousness. I think the fact that there's the next in line, maybe it was okay if his circumstances didn't allow it. His circumstances did allow him to buy it, but he didn't want to mar his own inheritance of what he was going to pass on to his kids. So, yeah, it doesn't look, you know, Boaz really generous, this guy not so much. So, all the people said, we are witnesses of this. So what they do is they take off your sandal, and I guess you give it to the guy. Hopefully you get it back, because there is there are various interpretations of this, but when you're going to make a deal, you would basically exchange the sandals, because it was obvious that you weren't just saying, okay, I'll do it. There was no misunderstanding. Yeah, we saw the sandal pass from one to the other. You don't take off your shoe and give it to somebody else, without purpose, because, like, they stink. Which reminds me of a great little, it's like, you should never criticize someone without walking a mile in their moccasins, because then when you criticize them, you're a mile away from them, and you got their moccasins. So anyway, so they can't chase after you, they yell at you. All right, so all the people said, we are witnesses, and then we have this little blessing. May Yahweh make the woman who has come into your house like Rachel and Leah, who built the house of Israel. Rachel and Leah, Jacob's wives. Do people remember the circumstances under which he got the two of them? Laban deceiving them. Deception seems to be a big thing here. And then they're actually foreigners. Although they were related, they had to go away to get them, and then they were brought in to the promised land. And then from them come the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, I'm not sure if the people understood that this is Ruth, a foreigner, coming in, but Holy Spirit basically has this blessing pronounced, which, you know, brings you back to the fact that, yeah, God includes people in the house of faith. You might also remember that Rachel brought the household gods with her and caused little problems, and Rachel and Lee always had problems. So anyway, may he treat you worthily in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Then we have this other thing, which I thought is like inquiring minds want to know, so we kind of looked up Perez. May your house be like the house of Perez. Who is Perez? I mean, who does that as a blessing? Whom Tamar bore to Judah. And maybe like the house of Perez, of the seed which Yahweh will give you of this one young woman. Basically, the kid Yahweh is going to give you from this young woman may establish a house like that of Perez. So who is Perez? Okay, so Judah had a son. I can't remember the guy's name. He dies. His brother is supposed to raise up offspring for his brother, and the guy's name was Onan, and he basically has sex with her, but then doesn't get her pregnant, deliberately pulls out so that his inheritance isn't marred either, and for that, God killed him. So then Tamar's there. She's just killed two of Judah's sons in his mind. And we have a third son coming up that she's going to wait for until the guy gets old enough. So remember how... Naomi said to Ruth, you know, even if I conceive tonight, you know, you're going to wait for the sons to grow up for me to give them to you? You know, maybe it was you're responsible for doing that. So there's a very similar parallel. Now, does anybody remember how Tamar managed to have Perez when Judah, right, she disguised herself as a prostitute. Was it around the threshing time again? It might have been. But she goes by the side of the road, but I can't remember why he was out there. And basically, he thinks she's a prostitute. He has sex with her, but, you know, he left his wallet at home. So she basically takes the staff and his signet ring and in exchange for a goat. So they go back with the goat, and she's not there. Now, it's like Judah is such a jerk. And he, this is Israel. I mean, this is the forerunner. So he's there saying, oh, yeah, she tricked me. Then he finds out that Tamar is pregnant. And his response, burn her. You know, like, whoa, dude, what kind of double standards going on here? And then she says, oh, just before you light that fire, the guy who I'm pregnant by, this is his ring and staff. Anybody recognize him? Anybody? Anybody? Judah, this look any familiar to you? And then, you know, he says, oh, you're more righteous than I. And, you know, so, and then he never slept with her again, which for her might have been a good thing. Who knows? So then Perez has sons, and then the lineage gets listed all the way up to Boaz, Obed, Jesse, David. And now we've got the genealogy intact. David's set to be king. His descendant Christ is, you know, in that line. So Boaz took Ruth. She became his wife. He went into her. Yahweh gave her conception, and she bore a son. So there's the actual terminology when they actually have sex. So it's not, you know, and midnight Moab perfume fuel thing down there. Okay, who said this? They said, the people must have said, blessed be Yahweh, who has not left you this day without a redeemer. Let his name be famous in Israel. Whose name? I think that's Boaz. So he's the redeemer. It's not a Jesus thing yet. Let his name be famous. He shall be to you a restorer of life. He will sustain you in your old age. This is said to Naomi. For Ruth, who loves you, is better to you than seven sons who has borne him. So here we have this, you know, poor, relatively helpless widow with a decision to follow God, loyally, humbly, working hard, doing the stuff that's in front of her. And she actually gets a blessing that is better than seven sons. The son was supposed to be a big deal because he'll take care of you. Seven sons, like, you know, you're golden. And, you know, super security. But, you know, God basically wound up, despite her efforts to foul things up, blessing Naomi, but does so through the faithfulness of Ruth. So our actions, this is going to be a question down below, really can have a positive benefit on others, even if they are not necessarily that blessable. So obedience to God's revelation has priorities over our wishes and desires. Where did I get that from? Well, Boaz was attracted to Ruth. Ruth was attracted to Boaz, but they basically followed what the law said first. The desires and wishes need to be held with an open hand, which means God can take it away. And when we're holding it, we're supposed to be working on what we know is right in front of us while awaiting God's timing. Psalm 84:11, the Lord God's a sun and a shield. The Lord will give grace and glory. No good thing will he withhold from them who walk uprightly. Is a good cross-reference to that point. Okay, we got 10 minutes, but don't have to take all of them for questions. Oh, yeah, he was definitely more righteous than his kinsman. Yeah, he was totally more righteous. See, the kinsman did not have concern for Ruth. He didn't care. He just cared about his own stuff. Oh, I might endanger my stuff. I'm not going to do that. So, wait, where's your, you know, you have the responsibility for Naomi and you have responsibility for her son's wives, and you're neglecting it, that's not righteous. So, I find it interesting that God directed Ruth into the field of Boaz. You know, just like a couple of these things where it's just like God is orchestrating this stuff. So the question was, here's Ruth submitting, and it's a good question to ask. I don't have an answer to it, but it doesn't stop me from making comments about it. It's never bothered me before. So Ruth is committed to following Naomi and her plans. In the ancient Near Eastern culture, what's the word for filial loyalty that was daughters? Anyway, the loyalty of parents, of children to parents, was like a really high, high value. You get stoned or, you know, put to death for not doing that. So she, you know, does kind of have that ingrained. She has, up until this point, trusted Naomi, and it's been good for her, but she committed to doing it. So she is basically told to do whatever he says. And, you know, in that culture, if he basically had, you know, taken her, and it would not have been like the worst thing in the world, because he would have followed through. So, with redeeming her. Yeah, I think if he had, because he's already demonstrated his concern for her well-being. You know, he's not going to just abandon her. And you also have to understand the role of women in the ancient Near East. In Israel, it was better than most places, but in the rest of the world, and then, you know, it's like it's not been a good scene. Well, she hasn't told. If your parents are telling you to disobey God's law, you need to be really careful about doing that, particularly if you want to live under the roof. But Roman, how do you make your decisions? What role do circumstances and desires play? Making your decisions is based on what God has revealed. And, you know, Paul and Peter said, you know, we must obey God rather than man. So, was that Acts 4:29 or someplace like that? So her submission to Naomi is something she had vowed to do. Now she's doing it. And Naomi is not specifically telling... It's sketchy, right? It's not sin. It's just sketchy. This part of this question here. How do you know you're not being ruled by your circumstances and desires? Let's see if I can pop that down here. Oh, that's a good... So the answer that was given was, if you're making decisions against your desires and you are finding joy in doing it, then it's a sign it's a good thing. What if you make a decision and you have great peace about it? All right, yeah, peace is tricky because a lot of people use the Colossians passage. So the peace of God rule your hearts. Well, okay, that's not talking about individual decision making. It's talking about unity within the body of believers. And I was reflecting on that recently, and when you're trying to obey God in something that you have not been obeying Him in, or you're trying to follow God in a territory where you have not gone before, are you going to feel peace or are you going to feel anxious? You're going to tackle giants in the promised land. Are you feeling peaceful or are you feeling anxious? All your life, you basically have developed brain patterns that basically say, danger, run, danger, run. You're probably not going to have a whole lot of peace. It's like you give an answer to everyone who asks you to help within you with fear and trembling because, like, you know, it's a scary thing. So often you will not have peace in doing the new thing because we are creatures of habit that are comfortable doing the thing we've always done. So a lot of times it's going to be kind of scary, so you need to look at what are your reasons and motivations for doing it, what God has said, not just, oh, the door's open, I'll walk through it. So circumstances and desires, yeah, hold them with an open hand. Circumstances, do you remember what Jesus said about ask, seek, and knock? If you're knocking on a door, is it an open door? No, it's closed. So, you know, you might want to do that. So you're not being ruled by them when you're also basically making your decisions according to principles that are valid and sound in the right context. What caused their motivated Ruth to be so loyal to Naomi? Beats me. Sure. So she made the decision, oh yeah, I'm going to follow you. And then Ruth says, no, I'll go back. Okay, I'll go back. She really wanted to go back. She was just looking for it. You know, the thing that's bad about her is she's going back to the false gods. She's never quite grasped that the true God is with the Israelites. But Ruth has this, you know, I'm going to die following your God. That is the defining characteristic of people that, you know, wind up making it to Faith's Hall of Fame and being pleasing to God and doing well at the judgment seat. Real quickly, last two here. How have your decisions and actions blessed others, or how do they bless others? Do you do just what's required, or do you enter into the intent of God's command? And this other one to consider, should you serve those who don't really deserve it? I mean, you look at Naomi, you think, does she really deserve it? Yeah, she's damaged. You know, she's hurt. She wasn't around the right fellowship to encourage God's perspective. She's going back because she hears his food. Yeah. you know, I can feel for her, but, you know, I think that it took an extra measure of grace to love the unlovely. However, why don't I throw in the second part of this question? How does the concept of stewardship affect your perspective on this question and your actions? You don't want to spend all your time on folks that are not responsive. No, just so... Oh, yeah, they don't really deserve it, but I'm going to keep on doing it. Well, no, you're supposed to basically stay at the house of a worthy person who is interested in truth. You don't just spend all your time, you know, trying to get the intractable to move after God. What did Jesus do? I go to the next town. Anybody coming? Because I'm not going to be here next Sunday at 11 o'clock. So if you want this, we're going to be somewhere else. You got to follow me. So he didn't just stay and stay and stay. So he basically was calling people to get on board. And, you know, you kind of need to make allowances and be guided by the Holy Spirit in terms of how you minister, who you minister to, how long you minister to them, what you minister to them in, and, you know, a whole bunch of other stuff. Which all comes down to, it's not just specifics, it's basically getting God's perspective and looking at things through God's eyes. Galatians 6:10, is that? Yeah, somewhere around 9 and 10. Do good to all men, particularly those that have, yeah, that's a priority of believers. Okay, Tempest has fugited. Let's pray and move on. Heavenly Father, we thank you that you're a God who is sovereign, a God who is in control, a God who can do anything, a God in whose hand are eternal delights and pleasures forevermore. Thank you that you know what pleases us, what's best for us, because you created us with those desires. Thank you that you can open your hand to fulfill them, but you do so according to a perfectly good plan, far better than anything we could imagine. Thank you that in the meantime, we can trust your grace. We can have freedom to do the things that you desire us to do because you strengthen us to do them. Thank you for Ruth's life, Boaz's life, and this according to the scripture of it by Samuel. I pray that you would help us be loyal and faithful to you, submitted to your will and word, and you would use us to bless those around us, not just for our generation, but also for the future. We commit ourselves to that task, for that's why you put us on earth. In Christ's name we give thanks. Amen.